Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans, and today this is episode 18 of the COVID Chronicles that we have been doing now for about 5 months. Dr. Robin LaCroix, the medical director and chair of the pediatrics department at Prisma Health Children's Hospital, is my guest today. Good morning, Dr. LaCroix.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. It's been a while since we've spoken. You've been on here before. I want to say it was probably almost 2 months ago, maybe month and a half, maybe something like that. But I'm glad to have you back, and obviously with your expertise, which, as I recall, and I didn't read it here in my description, but you also focus on infectious disease in children. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. My practice is pediatric infectious disease.
Well, there you go. Then you are the perfect person to talk to about COVID-19 and children.
Yes.
Fantastic. How are things going? I want to catch up with you a little bit since the last time we talked was quite a while ago. How are things going at the hospital now, especially in your department?
Certainly. Yeah, the community, since we last talked, has experienced a large increase in the number of cases in certainly the hospital has experienced more hospitalization, and Children's Hospital has continued to be busy. Fortunately, children have not been as significantly impacted as adults have through this pandemic, and we have experienced that as well, that children have been relatively not as significantly impacted in terms of the degree of illness as our adult counterparts.
Yeah, that's something that I think we've learned since the last time we talked. When we last spoke, it was still kind of up in the air, at least why that might be or even whether it might be. But as we have learned along and along, children just don't seem to respond to this virus the same way that adults do. Do we have any more research on that? Do we know why that might be?
We have learned a good bit over the last several months, and part of it is around the actual receptors that the virus attaches to cause disease. We believe that children have a lower number of these receptors. Mm. And so what we've seen now in multiple studies, both here and internationally, is that children's rate of becoming infected is lower, but they also are having lower amounts of viral replication in their respiratory tract, so that the amount of virus when they do become infected is much smaller, which has explained some of the lack of progression to severe disease in many of the children that have become infected.
Hmm. Well, you know, I saw that kind of in my own life. I don't know if you're aware of this, but I was actually diagnosed positive a few weeks ago, close to a month ago now, and went home and started doing the isolation. I started getting the symptoms. Most of them, luckily, were very mild. They were not particularly severe, but I did get rather a lot of them. it was easier to list the ones that I didn't get than the ones that I did. But we went through the isolation. We stayed home for I think 10 days is the protocol that that Prisma gives out. And we were kind of, my wife and I were kind of expecting all of us in the household to get it, because we've got kind of a small place. There's not much social distancing that we can do inside the house, and we couldn't go outside the house. So we were kind of expecting everybody else in the house to get it. I have three small children, and nobody else got it. No, I was the only one that ever showed any symptoms. I should say nobody else ever showed any symptoms. I don't know. It's possible that they were asymptomatic, because that appears to be one of the sort of defining characteristics of this disease, is that you can have it and just never show any symptoms and not know that you had it.
Right, that's true. And oftentimes people have been tested in response to a significant exposure or for another reason, and yet are asymptomatic. So I think that it is one of the things that makes this particular virus so difficult. And it's been one of the principles around the idea of continuing social distancing and masking and hand hygiene, because you're never sure that you may not be in the environment. You may have no idea from whom you acquired it. You may be
really
in an environment
don't.
and asymptomatically shedding and unbeknowing infect others around you. And that part of how this virus behaves in the population is one of the reasons that the messaging about, even though you feel well, you're protecting others and you are protecting yourself if you're not infected by masking and social distancing and adhering to hand hygiene and avoiding those large crowds and the things that we know create more people together and a higher risk of transmission.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned that that you might not know where you picked it up. I still don't know where I got it. Not really. And I was kind of surprised by that. I had this conversation with Dr. Sikosia last week, and I was expecting the contact tracing procedure to really narrow down and pinpoint exactly where I had gotten this, and it didn't. And it kind of dawned on me how much we still don't know about how this disease moves around effectively. And I still, to this day, don't know exactly where I got it. You mentioned that we've had this increased testing and that there's even been increased hospitalizations over at Prisma. Are any of those children? Obviously, I want to be, you know, sensitive to people's privacy. I don't want to give away too many details. But do you have any children that are hospitalized with COVID-19?
We have. And we continue to have, being the referral site for the entire upstate, we continue to have patients that are admitted to us from around the upstate counties that are positive for COVID-19.
Okay. And one of the things that we've discussed before is how people are handling other things that need to happen with their kids during the COVID-19 pandemic, things like wellness checks and vaccinations and things like that. And I know that Prisma has done a lot in terms of making sure that the places that those things happen are safe for people to still bring their kids into.
Yes, a lot of work has gone on in the practices. Obviously, every practice, their building itself, lends to the development of the plan. But the principles around asking people to wait in the car until their room is ready, if we need to have some of our patients that may come by public transportation may need to come into the waiting rooms, we've reconfigured the waiting rooms so that people are able to be distanced, their mask as soon as they arrive at the building, so that, again, we've got that extra layer of protection, parents and children, only the children less than 2 years of age. Those children are not being masked, but we're encouraging parents to put a lightweight blanket over their carrier because most of those children are in some sort of either car seat or carrier
right.
device. And that provides those children some protection, plus the fact that all the adults around them are in mask and the other older children are in mask. And then procedures in sort of the other portions of the office, some practices have chosen that all of their well checks are done in the morning, so sick visits are all reserved for the afternoon. Other practices have a building in which they can reserve a pod or a group of rooms that are very near a side or a back door. So if parents have a sick child, they're directed to that area, much like we did in the days of chicken pox. When somebody called in with a rash, you always came in the back door so that you didn't come through any common spaces. So we've been able, with many of our practices, to also modify to have separate entrance for people who are ill. And that way they're immediately roomed and separated from those children that are there to get their well checkups and there to get their sports physicals and there to get their immunizations that they may have missed during the time that things were during the stay-at-home order. Many, many children got behind on their immunizations and we're now working very hard to get those children caught up.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned chickenpox, and I know that one of the things that I have learned as a parent of young children is that chickenpox now is something that we have a fairly reliable vaccine for. When I was young, that didn't exist, at least not as far as I know. I got chickenpox when I was a kid. My sister got chickenpox. A bunch of my friends got chickenpox. It was kind of accepted that that was something that you were going to go through as a child, and it doesn't happen as much anymore, which is, again, the importance of those vaccines. One of the concerns that I've vaccinated for is things like that. Not obviously, we don't have a COVID-19 vaccine yet, but is it safe to get them the other vaccinations because they'll have a weaker immune system for a few days as they assimilate to that vaccine? Is that okay these days?
Absolutely. It's even more important because as we move through these febrile illnesses, we know that two very, very widespread viruses, measles and chickenpox, are so well controlled by vaccination. And those are both illnesses that are transmitted by droplets in the air. So again, if we had a circulating measles outbreak on top of the COVID, it would be very, very devastating to the children. So getting those preventative immunizations in so that the children are protected is just incredibly important, because then you're not dealing with whooping cough. About every 2 to 3 years, we have a significant increase in number of cases of whooping cough. And it's a very vaccine-preventable illness. But if you had a child who had whooping cough, which is pertussis, and that child then acquired COVID as well as a co-infection, their chances of having a significant respiratory compromise would be greatly increased. So being able to protect for the things that we have great vaccines that are safe and efficacious just makes sense, because now we have taken a second blow to a child that might acquire COVID out of the picture.
Is there a risk that a child who contracts one of those other diseases, measles or pertussis or something like that, would then be more susceptible to COVID-19? Because, I mean, we've talked a little bit about how kids just don't seem to get it very much. But if they've got the comorbidities that we have discovered in people, would we expect a disease like that in kids that they may be more susceptible to getting to be a comorbidity for COVID-19 as well?
Yes. So we know that both varicella, which is chickenpox, and measles, both cause a lowering of the immune capability to respond. That's why so often kids who've had those viral infections first go on to develop secondary bacterial infections because their immune systems are suppressed. So we know that having those and then a COVID infection concomitantly with that would certainly put them at much higher risk. The comorbidities, the children that we know have had the hardest time with this, are exactly the group with pre-existing lung disease, pre-existing heart disease. Those children are going to have a tougher time fighting both COVID-19, but they also have a harder time with all the viruses. But it certainly puts them at a disadvantage to fight this off and to fare through, like children that don't have pre-existing health conditions.
Is it standard practice, is it hospital procedure to test people for COVID-19 if they come in for other infections? Like if a child is hospitalized for, say, pertussis, as you mentioned, is it standard procedure to test them for COVID-19?
Because COVID-19 overlaps so many of the respiratory illnesses that children have, it can look like so many things. It can look like acute gastroenteritis and just the stomach flu. It can look like the regular flu. It can look like any of the other viral respiratory illnesses that children have. We do end up, when that constellation of symptoms, you know, fever, cough, malaise, the aches, the vomiting, the diarrhea, those constellation if we don't have another clear reason for that, then we move ahead with testing. Even if we have a clear reason, there is co-infection, and we're looking for that as well. We know now more and more studies are being published, and again, this information in the throes of our Seattle Children's colleagues and our Italian colleagues, they were in the throes of curing for patients. They're now being able to publish their experience. It's allowing us to have a snapshot and a path in which we can look and say, this is what has happened with them, and subsequently, we need to be aware of this as well.
We kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to specifically ask you about other health concerns that parents might miss with all of the focus on COVID-19. Obviously, we mentioned measles and chickenpox and pertussis and things that kids would usually get vaccinated for, especially young children would usually get vaccinated for. I've been seeing ads recently on television for meningitis B. Is that also a concern that might go under the radar if with all of the focus on COVID-19?
Well, certainly the vaccine series is sort of paramount as a preventative measure to keep children from becoming infected with vaccine preventable. And the meningococcal B is one of the vaccines that has entered the market over the past several years, because meningococcal disease can be so rapid in terms of its onset, particularly best portrayed in some of the college outbreaks. And so as the universities are preparing to get back, many of the colleges are now requiring these, we call them the adolescent series of vaccines, that we're sure that we're up to date with those. And meningococcal B has been included in that grouping of just another way to prevent, with an excellent vaccine that's safe, a really devastating disease.
So this is more precautionary, I guess, as all vaccines are, but as students are preparing to go back to, say, high school or college, that they may be susceptible to these things if they haven't had those vaccines updated.
Right. They're all, as they return to group activities, and we know how effective they are in being grouped up, that these are all, again, meningococcus is a droplet-transmitted infection. It's a bacterial infection, but it's transmitted with close personal contact. And so that is a vaccine-preventable disease that we know is effectively transmitted in those groups when we get those high schoolers and college kids all back together and living their college lifestyle.
I see. Before we move on and talk about school a little bit more, I just wanted to ask, what other infections might children be more susceptible to rather than less? Like, again, we've talked about how children seem to be particularly resistant to COVID-19. Are there things that we haven't talked about yet that come to mind?
Sure. Influenza is one of the ones that children have had an equally severe course as to their adult counterparts with influenza. And influenza, again, a vaccine-preventable disease, it is one of those that needs to be given each year. We have to have the new strain vaccine administered because the virus is very smart and continues to have these small mutations that allow it to evade the immune system. And so the vaccine manufacturers analyze these, because it is winter now in the southern hemisphere, and we can determine what is circulating and develop the vaccines based on what we know is present in the circulating communities. So a very, very important vaccine, particularly for this winter, is going to be influenza vaccine. I believe it's always important, but even more this year. We're going to begin to offer these earlier than in years past. And again, influenza and COVID will be indistinguishable in terms of their signs and symptoms. And you having experienced that, I know that you can speak into the muscle aches and the headaches and the fatigue and fever that comes with, which is identical in clinical presentation to influenza. So cocooning a community with influenza protection removes one virus that is we know has the potential to very deadly virus in even our country, and certainly more children died of influenza this past year than in many recent years. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very devastating virus for children this year. It rivaled the emergence of H1N1, the pandemic
the
that came
2000s.
Prior to this one. Yes, very, very devastating in children. So that push to get influenza vaccine done, the vaccine can be started as young as 6 months of age. So children can be protected at a very early age against acquiring influenza, and that's when the recommended first immunization is. And the first time, like so many vaccines in children, the first vaccine requires two. The first one tells the immune system to wake up and make some antibodies. The second one gives that an extra push to say, we want to be sure that you made antibodies, almost like a booster. We call it priming and then reminding. And so the first time children get it, they're going to get the two, and then subsequently every year after that, they can have the single vaccine that all of us get as our standard influenza vaccine. And certainly we know even the children that are vaccinated and become sick with influenza have a less severe course. So even if they go on to acquire it, that memory antibody that's there from the vaccine helps ramp up to protect a little bit more than someone who hasn't had the vaccine.
Before we run out of time, I do want to touch on schools. There's a great deal of debate right now about whether schools should open this fall. This is about the time that we would be, you know, looking for back to school deals and things like that. And the CDC and Governor McMaster say, yes, we should open the schools again. And in particular, school districts around the upstate and South Carolina DHEC say, maybe not so fast. Let's work out how exactly this is going to happen. Let's optimistically assume that we will be having school at some point in the future, and talk about what people need to look out for when kids go back to school.
You know, I think that the schools, I applaud the amount of work and effort that they are putting in to create an environment that can let kids return to learning in as safe a way as possible. And one of the reasons that the school districts are having to have very individualized plans is because our schools are all different. They're different in size. They're different in layout.
Sure.
And so they are really tailoring these to meet the constraints that they're operating under in terms of their physical plant, and to address the needs that they need to apply in terms of the infection prevention constructs that we know work, which is the social distancing, the masking, the hand hygiene, the environment, the avoiding the congregating of groups together, like where we might have had big assemblies. You know, we don't do things that way now just because of putting so many people in the same small space. So the schools have put an incredible amount of effort into this and are submitting these plans for approval. And they have had a lot of good input from both DHEC, the pediatricians throughout our state have assisted districts, and the pediatric infectious disease group within the state have made ourselves available to talk with school districts to help them think through plans to bring up specific things that we have felt might be helpful to them in implementing a plan, knowing that each of them has to modify it to fit their environment. So I think, you know, families understanding the plan their school has, knowing that it has had a lot of thought and has had input from many different aspects of how can we do this very safely, And then, you know, recognizing that each family needs to make their own individual decision about their situation and their children having a virtual or being with the in-person model. And it really does come to all of those factors adding together. But I think that parents feeling very educated around the options that are available is really important.
Well, and the CDC in particular has gone to a significant amount of effort in their guidance statements to point out the importance of education in child wellness, everything that goes along with school, you know, the meals that kids are served, perhaps they could even be safer at school than they are in their neighborhood or at home. There are things that go along with that. It's easy to get focused on COVID-19 and to the exclusion of other things. And it seems like they're just trying to remind people that, yes, we've still got COVID-19 to worry about, but these other things are important in child development, and that's why kids need to be back in school.
Yes, Chris, I agree. Having been a parent with two children, one in middle school and one in elementary school, and known firsthand what I felt like my children, I could not provide them in a virtual environment. I think that when you begin just from an educational standpoint, that the content and the robustness of what they get is so much better in the in-person model. I think that we have a group of children who are heavily dependent on their nutritional needs to be met to a great extent from the schools. Many of these children get their only reliable and certainly their most nutritious meals through the school. We know that the psychosocial development and socialization and developmental milestones are assisted by those group school-based models. We have many children that receive speech therapy, occupational therapy within the school setting and would not have access or the ability to get to those therapy services without school being in place. There are a number of children that get their psychology services through the school district and have not been able to have those as readily available when they're not in the school setting. So I think the CDC outlined very, very well all the value to school and the assured harms that come if kids don't have the opportunity to attend in person.
Yeah, yeah. As always, we should mention prismahealth.org/coronavirus as a website where you can go and get information about how Prisma Health is serving the community, especially in regards to testing, and even get your free symptom check there. And also 1063WORD.com is our news site, Entercom's news site, where you can find out more information about the COVID-19 pandemic here in the upstate and in South Carolina in general. Dr. Robin LaCroix, the medical director and chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Prisma Health Children's Hospital, has been my guest today. Thank you very much, Dr. LaCroix, for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chris.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.